Before I start the sermon this evening, you could turn to 1 Corinthians 13 a while. But before I start the sermon, I have three quick announcements. Vicky isn't here because she's sick. She fell sick Tuesday. She came Wednesday anyway, but she's just been really out of it since. Hopefully she'll be here this coming Wednesday. Doug is also not here because his shoulder has gotten worse. He said not only has the thing slipped, the plate, but the bone actually broke at one of the screw holes where the plate was connecting. Yeah, it's not good. In addition to that, his surgery got moved back to February because there was a lapse in his insurance, and he won't have insurance until February to get the surgery. And that's going to be like a five-figure difference. So kind of stinks he needs to make a decision like that. So pray for him. As far as I know, neither of them have any immediate needs. They're both fine as far as food and stuff, but they do want your prayers. Also, for our sermon this evening, I'm not starting yet, but I just want to say, I broke it in half just so it wouldn't be really long. So I'm going to have a part three, so that's why this will come up again next Sunday evening. All right, so for the sermon, in 1 Corinthians 13, verse 7, Paul writes that love hopes, or love bears all things, love believes all things, love hopes all things, and love endures all things. We talked last Sunday evening, I was preaching, about part of loving God is believing Him and believing in Him, despite there are things about Him we do not understand. One of the prime examples of that is creation. I cannot explain or quantify with math or any sort of science how you can create the whole world and universe with just your words. I can't explain that. I don't understand that. But I do understand He did it by faith. And even though I don't understand, I still love Him. I believe all the things He says. Now, that doesn't just apply to God. In fact, I think when it comes to the application for people, it's even harder, because God never lies. God is always good. He's consistent. Humans are not. So we're a lot harder to believe. But still, part of loving our brethren and other people is believing them. I'm going to primarily focus on our brethren, because in Scripture, our standards for how we treat our brethren are higher than just anybody. I'm not saying you don't treat your family like this or your friends like this. I'm not saying that. But we need to especially treat our brethren like I'm going to preach on tonight. So what I want to talk about tonight is just three things. Number one, it's important that we believe, we give our brethren or the benefit of the doubt, because that's what Jesus and the apostles did. I'm not proposing we do something they didn't do. Number two, I'm going to propose we do that because it's good for ourselves. If we learn to view people graciously and we endeavor to do that, it's also an opportunity to be introspective with why we view people like we do. And last but not least, it's important to view people and believe them, to give them the benefit of the doubt, because it's important for how we influence people. If we believe the better in people, that can believe the better in them, and if we view them as their worst and believe the worst and don't give them the benefit of the doubt, it can bring out their worst. So I want to talk about those three things this evening. First, turn to Matthew 26, please. In Matthew 26, we're just going to look at 36 through 41. This is the night that Jesus is betrayed. And while in the Garden of Gethsemane, He asks His disciples to pray for Him. And they don't stay up. They fall asleep. And Jesus' response is so encouraging and gracious. In verse 36, it reads, "Then Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane, and He said to His disciples, Sit here while I go over here, there and pray. And taking with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. And he said to them, My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me. Jesus really is asking his apostles to be there to support him. Verse 39, and going a little bit further, he fell on his face and prayed, saying, My Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. And he came to his apostles and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, So could you not watch with me 1 hour? You can almost hear the disappointment in his voice. But he doesn't just say that. 41. Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. So in one of the few instances where it seems like Jesus could actually use his apostles' help for emotional support, they're sleeping. And you know, if I was Jesus, which I'm not, he's God, I'm not, you know, I would have said, why not even bother bringing you guys here? But he doesn't respond like that. He says, he rebukes them softly, could you not stay up for an hour? But notice, he looks and views them for their better. He says, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Jesus knows they're not being slackers. He knows they want to help him. Otherwise, why would they come out with him? Why would they follow him? He knows they want to help him, but they're exhausted. He knows what they want to do and what they're capable of doing, or at least how capable they are opposed to each other. And he's acknowledging that. Yeah, he's a little bit disappointed, it seems, but he's still looking at the better part of them and acknowledging that. And that is so important. Because, you know, sometimes people are going to disappoint us. And how we frame that in our minds is critical. You know, nobody's perfect, in case you didn't know. And when you find out the people you love aren't perfect, there's two ways you can react to that. You can either A, say, well, I guess you were my friend, but it turns out you were evil all along. Or you can be like Jesus and realize their spirit is willing, but the flesh in that instance was weak. They are a good person who has a disappointing characteristic. This person who you've known for however long has been a friend to you, do you think they just changed overnight? No. They're just imperfect like you. Jesus acknowledges, he's like, I guess you guys aren't my disciples anymore. He doesn't throw out the baby with the bathwater. He still focuses on the good. Think about a child trying to help their parents carry in groceries. Are you going to be mad at them if they drop and spill the groceries everywhere? No. Now, what if your grown child is helping you carry the groceries and they spill them? Yeah, maybe you expect more, but at least they're helping you. It's not like they're lazy slobs sitting inside. Like, at least they're trying to help. But so often when we're disappointed, we forget that. We forget our teenage child was actually trying to help and their spirit was willing and they were just being a teenager and got distracted and tripped. We need to treat our brethren like that. And yes, they might disappoint us, but can we at least give them credit for trying? And maybe the reason why they disappointed us is because they didn't try. But is this person somebody who has proved to you through time that they're a good person? We shouldn't forget that because of one or two disappointments. And I know there's going to be a lot, but you know what I mean. Look at 2 Corinthians chapter 7. If you want an example, a biblical example of giving people the benefit of the doubt, look at 2 Corinthians chapter 7. There is, in my opinion, second only to Jesus dying on the cross, no bigger example of giving people the benefit of the doubt. So in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 11, Paul writes to the church in Corinth, For see what earnestness this godly grief has produced in you, but also what eagerness to clear yourselves, what indignation, what fear, what longing, what zeal, what punishment. At every point, you have proved yourselves innocent in the matter. So although I wrote to you, it was not for the sake of the one who did the wrong, nor for the sake of the one who suffered the wrong, but in order that your earnestness for us might be revealed to you in the sight of God. Therefore, we are comforted. And besides our own comfort, we rejoice still more at the joy of Titus, because his spirit has been refreshed by you all. For whatever boasts I made to him about you, I was not put to shame. But just as everything we said to you was true, so also our boasting before Titus proved true. And his affection for you is even greater as he remembers the obedience of you all, how you received him with fear and trembling. I rejoice because I have complete confidence in you. I just want to remind you, that was 2 Corinthians we just read. The same church where a man had his father's wife, and they were acting like it was no problem. The same church where there was all that division and fighting. The same church where there were Christians thinking it's cool to go to an idol's temple for all the wrong reasons. The same church Paul was bragging about. I'll read verse 16 again in case you forgot. I rejoice because I have complete confidence in you. Would you have complete confidence in the church in Corinth? I'll just say it. I wouldn't. I would view them as an unsound congregation and not be there. Maybe that's a bad thing. But when Paul was writing, was preparing Titus to go work with them, he was boasting about them. Now, I'm sure he also gave Titus a list of things to watch out for and address while he was there. Paul clearly, throughout both his letters to the Corinthians, corrected them a whole lot. I want to be clear. Giving people the benefit of the doubt and trying to look at the better part of them does not mean you put a blind eye to the bad parts. That's not what I'm saying. Paul clearly did not do that. Jesus clearly did not do that. But read verse 16 again. I rejoice because I have complete confidence in you. Look at verse 14. For whatever boasts I made to him about you, I was not put to shame. But just as everything we said to you was true, so also our boasting before Titus proved true. That almost sounds like he's not talking about the Corinthians. But when Paul was talking to Titus, and when Paul was thinking about the Corinthians in his mind, it's clear what he was doing. He was focusing on, hoping for, and believing in the better part of them. There's no other way to explain this passage. Paul is not hallucinating. He means what he says here. He had valid criticisms for them, but amazingly, and I really mean that, amazingly, despite all their flaws, he still somehow managed to have a positive outlook on the group. And I really think that's amazing. If Paul can view that the Corinthians that way, surely we can treat each other this way. Come on, we have it easy compared to what Paul had to deal with. And it's not just with the Corinthians. In Romans chapter 15, Paul writes to them saying, 1 Corinthians 15, verse 14, I myself am satisfied about you, my brothers, that you yourselves are full of goodness, filled with all knowledge, and able to instruct one another. Paul says that in Romans 15, verse 14. Right after chapter 14, where he's correcting them for judging and despising each other. So this group that is judging and despising each other, Paul says, are filled with all goodness. If I walked in a group and they were arguing and judging each other and despising each other about food and different days, I would not view them as being filled with all goodness. But Paul says they are, right after he corrects them for that behavior. And also, this group that doesn't seem to understand that the Jews in that group don't seem to understand that they can't bind the Jewish law on their Gentile brethren, he says, they're filled with all knowledge and able to instruct each other. So they have flaws, but despite those flaws, see how much confidence he still has in them? Yeah, you know, there's this area they need to work out, but they're still filled with all goodness. Yeah, some of these weaker brethren need to understand the big picture, but they're still able to instruct one another. Notice how he's believing and focusing on the better part of them. He doesn't make their mistakes his focal point. He's zooming out and believing in the better part. So what I'm trying to propose to you guys is something that the apostles and Jesus themselves did. They did it to a much greater degree than we normally have to. But it's also important for ourselves. See, if somebody comes to me and they tell me something, and if my first thought is this person's lying or they're trying to get something from me, you know, that says a lot more about me than it says about them usually. In Titus chapter 1, verse 15, Paul writes, "To the pure, all things are pure, but to the defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure, but both their minds and their consciences are defiled." Paul's just putting in, basically, we have a self-bias. We are biased towards ourselves. If we are thieves, we're going to tend to think other people are thieves and want to steal from us. If we're liars, we're probably going to be biased and think other people are going to be lying to us. But it goes the other way. If we're pure and honest, we're going to be, for lack of a better term, a bit naive and just assume everybody else is going to be honest. If we're hardworking, we're just going to assume most other people. And that's not a bad thing. It's just reality. We're biased towards ourselves. Usually, if we don't know something, we just fill in with what we do know, which is us. So when we are often thinking people are lying to us, well, is it because everybody around us is a liar? Or is there something going on inside of us? Matthew 15, verse 18, Jesus says, "But what comes out of the mouth proceeds from the heart, and this defiles a person." Now, I just want to say, viewing other people as thieves is not the only reason why people are paranoid about being stolen from. You know, that's an example of a heart problem. But you know who else is paranoid about people stealing from them? People who are insecure and materialistic. You combine those two things together, and that person thinks everybody's trying to rob them. You know who else is worried about people talking about others behind their backs besides gossips? People who idolize their reputation. Those people are always paranoid about people talking about them behind their back. So it's not just if you're worried about people doing this, that means you're doing it too. No. If we're constantly not believing and viewing the better side of people, that's often a sign of something twisted going on in our heart. Jim made a comment in Bible class this morning. Sometimes people are bitter towards others because they have a bunch of unresolved conflict. And that conflict kind of like rots and makes them bitter. That's another example of a heart problem. Maybe I don't believe something that a certain brother is telling me, or I won't ever view them for the better. Excuse me. Because I have an unresolved problem in my heart towards them. So then instead of taking them at face value or trying to believe the better of them, all I have is a bitter thing in my heart. That's another example. Sometimes it doesn't have to be general. Sometimes it can be really specific. So as we pursue being people who believe our brethren and view the better part of them, it's also an opportunity for introspection, because we're going to come across a lot of things that make me think, wait a second, why am I viewing this person like that for no good reason? We should look back and reflect on ourselves. Last but not least, it's so important that we understand how we our expectations for other people and how we view them changes how we treat them. And how we treat them with that view affects how they react. And we can bring out the good in people, and we can bring out the bad. Turn to 1 Samuel 25. That's our last passage. We're not going to read all of it, don't worry. We're just going to read two sections. So in 1 Samuel 25, David has fled the presence of Saul. Within the chapter begins with Samuel's death. And he's living in the wilderness of Paran, and there's a guy named Nabal who lives in Carmel. Nabal means fool. Nabal is a big or rude fool. And we're going to see how Nabal treats David and what he gets from that, and how Abigail, his wise wife, treats David and what she gets from that. And we're going to see in this chapter two very different Davids. Well, it's actually the same David, but he's going to react very differently based on how he's treated. We'll just read. 1 Samuel chapter 25, verse 5. Well, I'll start in verse 4. David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, "Go up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name. And thus you shall greet him. Peace be to you, and peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have. I hear that you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we did them no harm, and they missed nothing all the time they were in Carmel. Ask our young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give whatever you have at hand to your servants and to your son David." So David's approaching Nabal in good faith, basically saying, "I've been in your area. I haven't caused you any trouble." It almost seems like he's implying they've even protected Nabal's people. And he's asking, "It's a good day. It's a feast day. Please share with us." He's not threatening. He's asking. Now, what would a reasonable person do? Wouldn't a reasonable person say, "Oh, that's really nice. Thanks for protecting my men. Let me share with you"? That's not Nabal. Verse 10. "And Nabal answered David's servants, 'Who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat I have killed for my shearers and give it to men who come from I do not know where?'" Is Nabal giving David the benefit of the doubt? No, he views David, first of all, he's like, "I don't even know if you are David, and you're just some servant who's running away being some scum." Well, how do you think David's going to react to that? You think this is going to bring out the best in David? By the way, I'm not condoning his behavior. I want to be clear. But also, I'm not condoning Nabal's behavior. He gets the reaction he gets for a reason. Verse 13. "David said to his men, 'Every man strap on his sword.' And every man of them strapped on his sword. David also strapped on his sword. About 400 men went up after David, while 200 remained with the baggage." Nabal's about to die. But his wife Abigail intervenes. Let's pick up in verse 23. And look at how Abigail brings out the best in David and how she views the better part of him. "When Abigail saw David, she hurried and got down from the donkey and fell before David on her face and bowed to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, 'On me alone, my Lord, be the guilt. Please let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant. Let not my Lord regard this worthless fellow, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But your servant did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. Now then, my Lord, as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, because the Lord has restrained you from blood guilt and from saving your own hand, now then let the enemies of and those who seek to do evil to my Lord be as Nabal.'" You know what she just did there? David hasn't promised he's not going to kill anybody yet. She just got in contact with him. But as she's speaking to him, she's already speaking to him with confidence that he's going to do the right thing. She's speaking past tense about something David hasn't even agreed to yet. She's appealing to the better part of David that she knows is there. Verse 27. And now let this present that your servant has brought to my lord be given to the young men who follow my lord. Please forgive the trespass of your servant. For the Lord will certainly make my lord a sure house, because my lord is fighting the battles of the Lord, and evil shall not be found in you so as long as you live. Wow. He's about to kill her whole family, and she's speaking to him pretty confidently about his relationship with God and that he's a good man. Verse 29, if men rise up to pursue you and seek your life, the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living in the care of your God, and the lives of your enemies shall sling out as from the hollow of a sling. And when the Lord has done to my Lord according to all of the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you prince over Israel, my Lord shall have no cause of grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause, or for my Lord working salvation for himself. And when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your servant. Does Abigail sound like she has any questions about what David's going to do? No. She's talking about all these things in past tense, and when she talks about the future, it's only good. It's God's going to bless you, you are going to do well, and when you look back on this day, you will have no regrets. She's very optimistic about this man who has 400 men with swords ready to kill her husband and all their servants. That's giving somebody the benefit of the doubt. Read verse 32 with me. How does David respond? David said to Abigail, blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. Blessed be your discretion, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from blood guilt and working salvation with my own hand. What reaction did Abigail get from David? Very different from the reaction David got from Nabal, or Nabal got from David, wasn't it? Same David, right? Had the sword on his side, ready for battle. But one of them was evil and viewed David with evil intent. The other viewed David with goodness and love. And they got two very different responses. When I was in high school, I had two of my teachers in classes I excelled in treated me very differently. And once again, just like I was not condoning David's behavior, I'm not condoning my own. It was social studies and math. My social studies teacher and my math teacher, anyway, so both classes I excelled in. This was before I fried my brains with drugs. So both classes, whenever I got my assignment, I would do them both before class was over. Homework, whatever. I really liked listening to history, and I was really good at maths. So the classes were just easy for me to do and then just goof off. My social studies teacher, when she saw me, she recognized my abilities, so she utilized me to help teach the class, not be a co-teacher, but like when, if a friend of mine had trouble, I could help them. You know, looking back, I realized she identified me as a troublemaker, but by appealing to my better side, she put me to work. It was pretty crafty of her. My math teacher, on the other hand, you know what she did? She accused me of cheating. So whenever we would do homework, I would just do all the math in my head. And then I would talk with my friends and joke around. And she said, there's no way someone like you could do this all in your head. You're just copying the person next to you. Guess what I stopped doing? My homework. What's the point of doing it if she's just going to accuse me of lying? It got to the point where she made me sit by myself. Because I wasn't going back down. I know I could do it. And when I proved to her that it was actually me being able to, you know what she said? She said, well, at least you're finally applying yourself in my class. She would never give me the credit that I earned. Now, also, I was a big jerk, and I caused her a lot of problems, to be fair. But David isn't the hero of 1 Samuel 25, and I'm not the hero of this story. Which class do you think I learned the most in? My social studies class. Which class do you think I got the better grade in? My social studies class. Which teacher's name do you think I remember? Miss Smith, my social studies teacher. The only thing I remember about my math teacher was that her husband was addicted to sports betting. The way we treat people and how we view them can bring out the best or the worst, even with immature idiots like 16-year-old Matt. If you give people the benefit of the doubt, not only are you being like Jesus and his apostles, you can actually bring out a lot of good in people too. If there's anybody here who wants the help of the congregation, please come forward while we stand and sing the song of invitation.